Today we hit halftime. If you look at the book of Job, we get to chapter 28. And chapter 28 is somewhat of the band coming onto the field and doing their program. And then after this, Job moves in a very, very specific specific targeted direction until you see its conclusion. So today we're going to look at chapter 28. We may even move on past that a bit. Because after this, what it calls an interlude, chapter 29 through 31 is Job for the last time sort of stating his case and reminding these guys that are in front of him what he's said and kind of reminding them once again that he is not going to back down from the position that he's taken. Then, something that we probably would not expect or have not expected, after Job, we get one of his buddies speaking again. We keep laughing. I'm going to tell you, I keep laughing. Okay. Do you remember the names of the three guys? It's Bildad, Zophar, and Eliphaz, right? And you know how I've always kind of kept mixing up and getting the wrong name in there? Guess what? I'm not wrong. There's a reason why my brain goes sideways. Evidently, Elihu is either a name for either another person or one of those three, another name. I don't know which. So I feel a little bit vindicated. Okay. All right. So then we see Job for a couple of chapters. We see Elihu for a chapter or two. And then we have the big footprint. After all this back and forth, God speaks. I don't know about you, but for some reason, I never focused on the fact that God spoke in Job until he spoke with Job individually. But God steps in and speaks in the text, which is very interesting. And then you get the final conclusion between Job and God. So you can see there's a very distinct change of direction after this interlude that we're looking at today. So here's the interlude. And again, this is after Job is shared once more. In the interlude, I'm looking at, what version are we looking at up here? New American Standard, okay? So here from the New American Standard in 28, it says, "Surely there is a mine for silver in a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust, and copper is smelted from rock." Okay, so what's the thing that you see with all these this discussion of precious metals? Where do they come from? Okay, come to the earth, come from the ground. Okay, so follow that train of thought. Man puts an end to darkness, and to the farthest limit, he searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro far from men. The earth, from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Its rocks are the source of sapphires, and its dust contains gold. So you get the image here? What is it that that this interlude's all about so far? All these resources are what? Okay, they're all mined, which means somewhere inside the earth, right? Now, you have to understand to people at this time, this was somewhat of a mysterious thing. The fact that these metals would be found in the earth. And they did not necessarily know how they got there. However, I think that it is sort of interesting. You see in verse 5 there? There were some things that they had noticed. One of the things that they had noticed is in the ground, there is heat. There's fire. And that in some way, that has an effect as to why these things are existing in the ground. But generally, whenever we create a shaft that goes into the ground to go mining one of these things, it's pretty dark down there. So far, we're not talking about anything really deep. He's going to use this as an analogy. But he's talking about all these metals and all these things, they're either precious or valuable. You see that? Gold, silver, those are valuable, right? Okay. They saw copper and iron as being useful, maybe not as valuable. We might not think of iron as being valuable, but it was certainly useful. Okay, copper we see as being a little bit valuable. They saw it as being mostly useful, but they had value. Then they talk about sapphires and yes. It's something that in order to get to these valuable resources, they had to work hard. And it wasn't like us. You know, we can go pinging around with all these electronic things and go, yep, it's right there. We'll just start right here and we'll drill here. It wasn't like that. They had to look for outcroppings or some kind of evidence that these things existed somewhere, and then they would go mine. So let's go to the next. The path no bird of prey knows, because it's in the ground, right? In order, whenever you're mining these things and there's a shaft, there is no, birds don't go there, okay? Birds don't go underground. Nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the base. He hews out channels through the rocks, and his eye sees anything precious. He dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light. So who's he? Is it a guy or is it God? Because I'm not sure. Is it talking about the person who does the mining, or is it talking about God who knows the stuff's there? It does. I'm going to tell you, in NIV, it says, instead of he in 10, it says man. Okay? Your versions may give us a little bit more. You know, if you have a different version, let me know. But that's one good thing that using multiple versions can help us clarify those things sometimes. Yep. John said this is New American Standard. Yeah, mine's in NIV too. That's interesting. Yeah, I've got 8 says, proud beast, do not set foot of it on it, and no lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock. Yeah. So anyway, it seems like right now it's talking about human agency. Okay, so people have to work hard to get these things, to get to these things, to find these things, okay? And then the whole idea is he works hard to bring them out, and then they are either useful or valuable once all this effort's been put. Does this make sense? Okay, now this is all an analogy. In other words, we have to work really hard to get this stuff out, and we don't even know if it's there, okay? We don't know where to go. We find it, and then we have to apply ourselves to get it. People got to work hard. So in verse 12, we turn the analogy into an application. But where can wisdom be found? We've been talking about all this stuff that's valuable, that's desirable, but now we're going to talk about wisdom. So he's juxtaposing the idea of all this precious stuff and the work it takes to get to it with wisdom. This isn't either one of them speaking. This is the interlude. This is the narrator. Okay? So where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, in other words, whether it's deep in the earth or deep in the ocean, it doesn't matter. The deep says, it's not in me. And the sea says, it's not in me. Next slide there, John. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned. And the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So do you see the comparison that's being made? Wisdom is more, it goes back to the same thing that Solomon found out. Whenever God said, what do you want? Solomon said, I want wisdom. God said, good choice. And so here we have sort of an affirmation of that same thing, in that wisdom and understanding God, and wisdom being this place that we are in God's care and paying attention to what He says, that is the place that you want to be. It is more valuable than all the stuff. But it raises the question, how hard are you? Are you working as hard to endeavor with wisdom as you are with the valuable stuff? Does that make sense? So he says, where then does wisdom come from? Where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all the living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it. In other words, we know wisdom exists, we just don't know where it is. God understands its way, and He knows its place. He looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When He imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure, when He set a limit for the rain and in a course for the thunderbolt, then He saw it and declared it. He saw wisdom and declared wisdom. He established it and also searched it out. And to man He said, behold the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Now, why would that last statement be so important to put in this interlude? This statement goes to the core of a relationship with God. These guys that are talking to Job are saying that it's about a lot of other things because they can't explain why all this bad stuff would happen to him. But here in the interlude, it says, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. Does Job fear the Lord? So who has wisdom in this discussion? How can we, what would you say would be evidence that perhaps the three amigos did not fear the Lord in the same way? They do have some things, but they don't have understanding, do they? Do they have wisdom? Is there evidence that perhaps they don't necessarily fear the Lord? Just something for you to be thinking about. Because there's a reason for this statement. There's a reason why it's positioned here at halftime. There's a reason why the leader of the band, right before you leave halftime, says, behold the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. And it has something to do about the conversations back and forth that we've been reading and discussing and trying to learn from. So do you see, what do you learn from the analogy in 28 here? Paraphrase. Okay? What about wisdom? How do we gain wisdom? Real wisdom. Well, you know, this fear, there may be an element of fear when you put into the equation the holiness of God and our understanding whenever we are confronted by that holiness that we aren't. So there is fear that's there, that should be rightfully there. He's God, I'm not. He's holy, I'm not. And there's an incongruity between the two that should concern me. Okay. But at the same time, that fear is not just to be afraid of. What are the other elements of that fear that we know we talk about a lot of times?
I think it's both and.
Because we're talking about where does wisdom come from? Wisdom comes from being in this relationship that we understand this awesome God, even if it's this much. And that we understand, let's see how to say this. Getting wisdom is not like having a drone drop it on your front step for you tomorrow morning. Wisdom is a lot more like being a miner. And it comes from y'all know relationships take work, right? Effort, investment, commitment. And in order to get something out of the ground like gold, silver, or any other precious resource, somebody's got to work. Energy has to be expended. Do you see the parallel? All this stuff about all these precious things, it's not just we're going to go off on a tangent. It's a matter of trying to draw an analogy for what it means to gain what only God has. And if wisdom begins with this reverential, awesome fear of God and being with Him, it means engagement, commitment, investment. Yeah. 1 John puts a different, another element in this. And I'm going to, we try to talk about this, and I think we've talked about it as long as I've been around here, but I'm going to talk about it again. In 1 John, it talks about children, young men, and fathers. And the way you get to be father, mature, is to be one who has won battles and learns from those battles and then pours into other people. Young men are fighting battles. They are learning at the time that there are spiritual battles to be fought. Children are just learning what the whole thing, what the scheme is. They're getting the lay of the land. The reason I bring that up is that many times in the church in America, we have made it, all you got to do is get this stuff between your ears, and when you get it all between your ears, you're mature. Hogwash. Okay? It's a matter of acting and living what you learn. You're only wise when you actionize the revelation you get. Does that make sense? So if I know I'm supposed to forgive my neighbor and I don't forgive my neighbor, I'm not wise, even though I know it. I have this conviction that it's truth, but until I do it, I can't grow in wisdom. Does that make sense? Or I may know that I'm supposed to be more interested in the interests of others than I am in myself, the way that Jesus was. And until I do that, I know it, but I am not wise until I do it, even though I know it and I believe it. Does this make sense? So wisdom is a really hard thing because it means I have to actually live this stuff. I can't just know. And then it goes back to, well, what did Jesus mean when he said no? K-N-O-W. Did he mean no, or did he mean no? Wisdom. This sets up, who was it that was in this dialogue? Who is it that had said you got to have it all set up, and you got to understand it, and you got to categorize it and systematize it, and this is the way God works? Who was saying that? The three amigos. They had a system, and Job was not fitting in their system. They were living up here. They didn't understand wisdom. Does it make sense? The interlude is reminding us they weren't wise. And there's a very clear distinction between the two. What do you have to do to have an easy path in life? Or for life to go well? For life to go well, you obey the rules. You stay inside the lines. And if you don't stay inside the lines, then God will squash you. And then you get Job, who is the thorn in their system, because he's had to go through all this stuff that they normally would say would be happening to somebody who had not gained wisdom, had not lived within the system, and it makes no sense to them. They do not understand wisdom, because wisdom is about relationship and learning and growing and doing the things that come about through that personal learning of knowing who God is. Yeah. Yes, I do. And we struggle with that because that's what we've learned. I don't know about you, that's what I learned. And to some degree, that's what I learned in church, in America. I'm trying to make sure I remember what it was that I was thinking on that story. It is important that we do understand grace, what grace is, that we don't trample the grace that we've received, treat it as, of course, it's not our works that save us, it is grace. We do things because we love God. Now, here's something that a lot of people struggle with, and I think we all do, at least I do. You know, the reality is, when we do things God's way, there is a blessing inherent in that. even if we don't get the results that we want or expect, there is a blessing in doing things God's way. That's what the Ten Commandments was all about. That if you live understanding these things, your life will be better. God has said that. You honor your father and your mother, life goes better than if you don't honor your father and your mother. So there's a value there. There's a reason why. Have no other gods before me. Okay? Life will go better. It's not always that if you do this, you get this, but there is an inherent blessing in doing things God's way, even if it doesn't reap the result we want or expect. That's not what Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar were saying. Thank you. So far, so good. Yeah. So, they were saying, you do this and God is obligated to do this. You do this and you're going to get squashed. Different things. All right. Are you with me? You get the interlude. All right. So what we'll do, I can't see the shiny reflection off that. We're about to the end. So next week, what we'll do is we'll pick up and we're going to deal with all three chapters, 29, 30, and 31, of Job's final defense. Okay? We'll look at what he says. And the reason why is because even though it's three chapters, it's a lot of the stuff that he's going to be restating, sometimes in the same way, sometimes in a different way, the things that he has said. So this is kind of like he is a lawyer and he is summing up his defense. Yes. I don't know that there is. There may be, but I don't know that I have ever seen a definite, you know, there's sometimes people will venture out and say, oh, there's a secret in this, or there's some message in it. And there might be. But then again, sometimes people, I think, take those things a little too far. So yeah, it could be that there's some importance in those names. I'll go see if I can figure that, if there is. I hadn't thought about that because anything I've ever read has really not gone to seed on that. So I haven't really worried about that a whole lot. It hasn't really changed the message of the text any for me. All right, but it's a good question. Anything else? Okay. Hey, Jay, would you close us?